Coverage advantage is the allowance of up to 2 classes at a local high school with no allotment reduction. Your student can learn at his or her pace and still be connected to friends in the school district. Homebridge, Juno's hometown homeschool, 209-HOME.
Well, good afternoon. This is Pat Moore, and I'll be hosting Juno Afternoon today on KTOO News. We'll be talking with Kit and the Caboodles, at least a couple of members of them, who will be playing at Friday night's ball in honor of Alaska Day. Keith Butler will come in with a preview of a talk he'll be delivering on military explosives. Linda Spearstra and Angela McGraw will join us from Sitka's new Archangel Dancers. And Nancy DeCherney will be here with news and views about local activities during Arts Up. Weather forecast, rain showers, highs around 44, southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, and tonight mostly cloudy, isolated rain showers in the evening, patchy fog late.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native elders and youth revive a tradition at the 2011 Elders and Youth Conference in Anchorage, Alaska. This year, the 3-day kickoff conference, which wrapped up yesterday, included men's and women's houses. National Native News anchor Antonia Gonzalez continues her special report from the Dena'ina Convention Center.
The genders split into separate groups, men's and women's houses, for about 2 hours Wednesday afternoon. In each house, elders shared wisdom about the strength of men or the power of women. Earl Polk, known by his Yupik name Kuthluk, explains the men's house, where topics like hunting and life skills are discussed.
Basically, literally, in translated into our language, is Qazri. It's the men's place for gathering, and what we do is it's a place to share, to learn, to grow, to express, to address the issues that face us as men.
Kuthluk says there were so many issues to cover that 2 hours didn't even scratch the surface. But he says he challenged the youth to continue the tradition when they get home. The houses were unique to the conference this year. In Anchorage, I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Elders and Youth Conference, in its 28th year, is hosted by the First Alaskans Institute. Elders and youth are connected to address issues in leadership and education, health and wellness, and language and culture. Today, the gathering will shift into the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention under the theme Strength in Unity. This week, U.S. senators are praising the life of Eloise Cobell, a member of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana, who died on Sunday. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Because of the work of Cobell, Native Americans won a settlement of more than $3 billion from Congress. She was treasurer of the Blackfeet Tribe for more than a decade. Under her scrutiny, she found bad accounting on behalf of the U.S. government that held her tribe's trust. She filed a lawsuit in 1996 against the U.S. on behalf of more than 500,000 Natives, which was settled for billions. Montana Democratic Senator Max Baucus praised her life on the Senate floor.
Eloise was a brave member of the Blackfeet Nation, my home state, Montana, who fought tirelessly for what was right. On Sunday, the world lost a great hero. Native American people everywhere lost a champion.
Baucus says Cobell's attention to details righted a massive injustice perpetrated on Native Americans.
For more than 100 years, the federal government did not fairly compensate Native Americans in Montana and across the nation for revenue generated from their land.
Baucus and Montana Senator John Tester introduced legislation earlier this year to award Cobell the Congressional Gold Medal, one of the highest honors the federal government can bestow. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Services for Cobell begin tomorrow in her home state of Montana and conclude Saturday as she is laid to rest in the family's Blacktail Ranch south of Browning. During this week in 2010, the U.S. federal government announced a settlement in the Keepsiegel case. The lawsuit was filed in 1999 on the basis of discrimination and the denial of access to farm loan programs. Under the agreement, the government would pay a total of $760 million, with a $680 million of that amount towards damages and a forgiveness of $80 million in outstanding farm loan debt. This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institute, dedicated to improving the health of the Native American community, funding health promotion interventions mutually developed by tribes and researchers. Learn more on how your local community can participate at www.grants.nih.gov. Support for National Native News comes from the National Library of Medicine, featuring its new interactive exhibition, Native Voices, examining the concepts of health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. On the web at nlm.nih.gov/native voices.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
A little later in the program, we'll hear an update on news about the AFN convention going on up in Anchorage this week. Right now, however, we're going to hear about an event which is coming up tomorrow night. My guests are Alaska's Kit, who does not use a last name, and Doug Bridges, members of Kit and the Caboodles, the band that will be playing at Friday night's Alaska Day Ball in Juneau. So, Kit, tell us how this band got started.
Alaska's Kit and the Caboodles got started when I had the dream and the ambition to get out and start performing locally around the town. And my vocal coach at the time was Kari Groovin, and I told her about this dream of mine, and she introduced me to a man named Steve Wild, who's a guitarist. And together we started the band Alaska's Kit and the Caboodles, and from there it took off, and I've been lucky enough to be able to keep doing this for 5 years, and it's been a wonderful, enriching experience with these guys. They're fantastic, all professional musicians in my opinion, and they're all wonderful, and I'm just so glad that they're there to help me out.
Hey, Doug, how many Caboodles are there at the moment?
Well, the current stock of Caboodles is, what are there, five of us? Let's see, there's Dale McFarlane on drums,
mm-hmm.
Jim Knoll on piano, Miguel Reyna on bass, and then Kit and myself. And there's been sort of a revolving Caboodles roster over the years.
And you're the sax man.
I'm the sax player.
Okay. Okay. So your music, I think, based on the little samplings that I've heard, could best be described as eclectic in nature.
Yeah, we do all sorts of music. Usually it's fitting to either my personality and what kind of music I enjoy to sing, or others that the guy suggests, which are great tunes. And then other times, like for instance the Alaska Day Ball, in which we're doing 40s and 50s music, the music applies to the venue.
So 40s and 50s music, Doug, would include like what? It sounds like...
Well, we're doing... we're doing mainly vocals, some instrumentals, but Kit's doing things like, you know, from In the Mood and Chattanooga Choo Choo, and then we're doing different kinds of jazz and popular standards, Fly Me to the Moon, There Will Never Be Another You, just a lot of kind of standards from that era.
So it sounds like the I think this thing starts at 6 o'clock with dance lessons. They must be going to teach the foxtrot.
That
would be appropriate, and we have a song for that, and that's called Fever. Everybody seems to know that one, and that actually will probably be the one they play, because that's the one I learned foxtrot from.
Do you know who's doing the dance lessons?
I believe it's Dan and Lorinda Kastner.
Oh, okay. and that's included in the price of the ball ticket, I would assume.
Yes, it is.
They're separately charging for it. Okay. And then the actual dance is 7 to 11.
Yes.
And the band will be performing. Are you the only band for the event?
Yes, we are indeed. We're very lucky.
Okay. Now, the posters that were out said that period costume was encouraged. So when we say period here, we're looking at 40s and 50s, right?
Yes, we are, okay. Because that's when we became a statehood in the 50s. And so we're trying to this Alaska Day Ball is in remembrance of Alaska Day. So
give me a for instance of what a 50s outfit would look like.
Oh,
what would I wear? What do I need?
What would you wear? You would wear, I believe it's called a duster. Is that something?
Well, we have another person in the studio.
We have another.
She's the silent party over here in the corner. This is Kit's mom, which is an odd name for a person, but that's how she introduced herself to me. Kit's mom, would you tell us your real name, please?
Her name is Karen, and she
You're
is
online.
A member
she,
of
she can
the,
speak for herself here.
Yeah.
Well, a duster is actually something that they wore back in the, I believe, the 1900s, 1800s.
But a little bit early then.
Right. So the period costume can be for anything from when Alaska Day was... The Alaska Day came about as the transfer of the state. Seward wrote the check, mm-hmm. and it was transferred from Russia to the United States.
So that's
states.
In the 1800s, actually. So,
right.
Yeah, okay.
So you're looking at 1889... I want to say, or is it 1887? I'm getting a little confused on my dates here, but
I'm not going to guess. I'd look it up. I'd Google it.
That's what I do too.
Yeah. Yeah. So somebody with a phone, quick, Google a date. Okay.
Or but yeah, so
maybe
the
somebody will
costume.
Walk in the studio and say, "You dummies!" It was.
I know. That's why I'm afraid the pioneers are going to come back at me and say something.
We should say this event is sponsored by Igloo 6. The men's and women of Igloo 6 are sponsoring the event this year.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Well, regardless of the date, now this 40s and 50s costume is what we're actually talking about. We're not wearing dusters here. Let's see. This is after wide lapels. So we're talking about leisure suits, aren't we? Are we up to leisure suits yet, or is that the
60s? Think of Frank Sinatra.
Think of Frank. Okay.
The big band,
okay.
Frank
go.
Sinatra, the
okay.
nice ball gown.
A fedora. Right, okay. Which, by the way, Kit is wearing an almost fedora here in the studio. So, anyway, people are encouraged to come in costume, but you can just come dressed casually.
Yes.
And
it
basically
is.
It's just a chance to have a good time. Let's see, are they serving food? Or?
Yes, they are. Yeah. Abby's Kitchen is providing appetizers.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely delicious. Just looking at the menu makes my mouth water.
Can you give us a sample of what made your mouth water?
I can't tell you the exact names off the top of my head.
How about that filet mignon?
Oh, filet mignon, is that going to be on
there? Uh-huh,
yeah.
Wild smoked salmon.
Ah, my.
And... stuffed mushrooms.
So there's no point in going to dance. You basically just go hang out at the table and eat.
Well, it was set up to do a dance for where people are encouraged to get involved with their community, visit with each other, get to know your neighbors, get to know people, listen to live music. It's a way of getting the community involved. And Alaska's Kid is... And the Caboodles are going to be playing music, but you'll also be able to get to visit with people as well.
Sit around and talk and mm-hmm. just kind of have a good time.
Yes.
So it's $25 for singles and $40 per couple,
yes.
I think is the price. And somebody said the tickets are available at the door and at Hearthside Books.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, and this thing starts at, the dance lessons start at 6 o'clock, and it's Friday night,
mm-hmm.
tomorrow night in Centennial Hall, and the band is going to... going to start wailing at 7 and go to 11, huh?
Oh, wailing. I'm sure, yes. Yes, indeed, we will be starting at 7 and we will be going to 11. Hopefully, it depends on how many people are still there. We hope as many people as can come to the event. It's a great event and it's fun. And it's... put on by the pioneers, and the pioneers of Alaska, they're dedicated to preserving the history and the art of the entertainment of the cultures of all people. So they're a great great organization, and so it's a great event.
Well, I think the only logical response to this thing at this point would be to play the Alaska flag song as a way of kind of getting people in the mood for this event. Shall we do it?
I agree with you. Yes, thank you.
Good, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
The Alaska flag song reminding us that tomorrow night is the Alaska Day Ball in Juneau, and that event will start at 7 o'clock at Centennial Hall. This is Pat Moore. I'm sitting in for Jeff, who's up in Anchorage, receiving a Lifetime Achievement in the Arts Award, and asked me to take over the show for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of this week. So that's why you're hearing a strange voice on your radio. It's 18 minutes after 3. My next guest are a couple of people who handed me a wonderful pin a minute ago, and I'll tell you about that as we get to know them better. Keith Butler is here from the Milan Army Ammunition Plant in Milan, Tennessee, and Lisa Hoferkamp is a chemistry professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. And they're here because Keith is going to give a talk as part of the American Chemical Society lecture series. It's tonight, right? Yeah, tonight. And Keith is going to be talking about military explosives. So, Keith, without giving away your talk tonight, how is it that you come to Alaska to talk to us about military explosives?
Well, the American Chemical Society is the world's largest scientific organization. We're scattered across our country and several foreign countries as well. We have over 163,000 members, and it's hard to serve all those members. So the membership is broken down into 180-some-odd local chapters. We call them local sections. Alaska, with all its great real estate, is only one local section. So in order,
so the average section of this is 549,000 square miles, right?
This is probably geographically the largest. But in order to try to serve all of our members, the American Chemical Society has a program of tour speakers where they fund a speaker, a guest speaker, to come to the local sections and present interesting, hopefully interesting topics or cutting-edge topics. Lisa can sometimes invite speakers to the section that are local, maybe from their local professors or local industry. But after a while, you've heard everybody local, so you want to hear somebody from outside, somebody with a different experience. So I've been graciously invited to come celebrate National Chemistry Week with the Alaska Local Section.
And you told me before that this is National Chemistry Week.
National Chemistry Week is the third week in October, and there's a chemical standard, a number that we use. The exponential to it is 10 to the 23rd. October 23rd is National Chemistry Day, so we celebrate near that. And
Avogadro's number?
Yes, no. Avogadro's
right
number.
All right.
Good. Okay. Good. So I started out at Fairbanks, and then I went to Anchorage, and now I'm finishing up at Juneau. So I've seen some wonderful, wonderful scenery as I've been here and had some wonderful hospitality by the folks that have joined us. But the local section, there's, I think, about 120 members in the Alaska local section.
Is that the case?
Correct.
Uh-huh. Are you like the president? Or
I'm the counselor
the
for the next couple of years.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But I'd like to brag about these guys just a little bit.
Yeah, please do.
But they... The American Chemical Society wants to recognize the hard work of all the volunteers. Lisa's a volunteer. There's a gentleman up in Anchorage, Fairbanks, that serves as a president, and he's a volunteer. It's all volunteer efforts. He's
The chairperson, the president of the local section.
His name?
Oh, Bill Howard.
Bill, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's
Dr.
professor
Howard.
Of chemistry.
They have been recognized nationally as an outstanding chapter. Out of the 189,000, most of them are small sections. My local section down in Tennessee was also nominated. But in Denver last summer, Lisa came by and she grabbed the trophy. Took it away from us. You know what I mean? So you got a group of very dedicated chemists here. I think,
Lisa, what does a section have to do to win this honor?
Well, we have to present options for the public to learn about chemistry, like we're doing with this public lecture series. We offer students of chemistry at the universities and the high schools opportunities to expand their knowledge on chemistry and generally promote chemistry.
Is there a major in chemistry at UAS?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay.
But there is at UAA and UAF.
And so. How many chemistry professors make up the department here? Would that be Lisa?
Me and Mike Steckel.
Oh, Mike Steckel. Okay, so there are two.
Yes, we're the two chemistry professors.
And then most students that you would have would be taking it as one of their general education requirements, a lab science?
No, we teach in support of the biology program.
Oh, okay.
And
okay,
the environmental sciences
program.
Right. No, people don't take organic chemistry for general education. They might.
I remember a sign when I was going to college that said "honk if you pass PCAM." I think was the bumper sticker. Yeah. Anyway, so that's physical chemistry, I think. What's your specialty?
My education is in inorganic chemistry, but my occupation is more analytical. We're the guys that do the testing, you know, like you see on CSI or some of the television programs like that. We have the instruments that they don't work quite as fast and as straightforward as they do on television, but we're not in the entertainment business. We're in the information business.
And you're not on a 59-minute schedule with a room out for advertising between program segments, right? So could you describe some of the work that you do?
Well, we have two missions. One of them is we are in an ammunition plant that assembles ammunition for the United States Army, most of the other branches of the military, as well as our allies. When we do these things, we have to meet very, very tight military specifications. You've always heard the phrase, you know, keep your powder dry.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our tests are so simple as monitoring the moisture content of the powder. And if the powder is a little damp, it will still shoot. But it may not burning quite as hot, and the projectile will fall short of the target. So you want your powder very dry. But if you get it too dry, it shoots too hot and it goes over the target. So we have a very, very narrow window where we have to keep that and control that. But we could check anything from the powder to maybe what's the composition of the explosive. A lot of explosives are blends of three or four different components. We break those down to identify what the, each one of them are, and are they in the correct proportion. Or maybe we check a really small metal part that's deep inside of a real complicated round of ammunition. Or maybe check the metal hinges that are on the wooden box that it's packed in. The military wants all these components to withstand extreme conditions, whether it's on an ocean ship, whether it's in the cold, dry air of Alaska or the hot, dry air of the desert. And all that has to be done within military specs. But one thing that's interesting is that most of today's chemistry is practiced with electronic instruments, microprocessors. And every time you have a switch that activates, there's potential for a spark. Sparks and arcs are not compatible with explosives when you might have them in the air. So the things we do oftentimes are the things that really attract most of us to chemistry, the wet chemistry, the glassware and the reagents and watching things boil and turn. And we do a lot of 1950s, 1960s type techniques because explosives are not that compatible with modern things. The second mission we have is being good environmental stewards. We are sitting on a Superfund site. Back 70 years ago when we started, we weren't being malicious or negligent. It was just that the art of the day didn't realize that those kind of practices would contaminate the environment. We've learned better. We stopped, and now we're trying to clean it up. And we actually are cleaning it up. We're making
this
some good progress. This is in Milan, mm-hmm. but we're not alone. The Army had over 20 ammunition plants scattered across the country during the height of World War II. They've gradually phased down. Now there are only a handful, four or five. But most of those sites are in the process of either being studied, cleaned up, or have been cleaned up and closed and released for public use now.
So people who come to the lecture tonight will hear you talk about?
They will hear me talk about the history of military explosives. What I will talk about some is I want to talk about weapon systems that were primitive and how they've gradually advanced to more modern weapon systems. And a weapon could be anything that a soldier or warfighter could use to defend himself or to achieve his goal. If you can put explosives on that, you make it more efficient and more effective. So we'll look at those different weapon systems and see how military explosives make those more effective. And then it's a chemistry lecture. So we're going to talk about some of the chemical reactions of detonating explosives. We'll talk about some of the physics of the detonation process. And then we'll look at several classes of explosives so we can see the unique molecular structures and different classes and families. To someone that enjoys chemistry, there's some beauty in just seeing the molecular structures and the great variety that's there. And then we'll talk briefly about some of the future trends, where it's going from a munitions point of view, where it's going from a research and development point of view. And I'll have a few visual examples, you know, PowerPoint slides, of how the military takes those explosives and weaponizes it. We call that ordnance. And maybe have a video or two as well.
And this event is at 7 o'clock tonight. It's in the Anderson Building, which is the newly acquired, I think, in the last couple of years. The University of Alaska acquired the property across the street. Am I thinking of the right place?
Next door to the Anderson Building. But the Anderson Building has been around since the 70s. I've got a nice old picture of it. It's next door to the old NOAA lab on Ock Bay.
Yeah, okay.
Right. It's not on the main campus. It's down off of Glacier Highway.
So you go around
Highway.
The loop like you were going down to the Ock Bay Boat Harbor.
Correct.
Turn,
but it's
turn
before,
left off
yeah,
of it. Okay.
It's before that.
Okay. And it's at 7 o'clock. There's no charge.
No.
Right? Okay. And let's see, it's in room 204.
Room 204.
Is that like large enough to hold how many people?
Probably 75.
Oh, okay.
So I don't think there'll be
no big problem to
It'd be great
to
if
get
you build
a, it. Yeah, I hope you do. Mr. Butler, I notice here you have worked for the military for quite some time. It says you have 24 years experience doing acceptance testing. Was all that at Milan? Or?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So you must know your explosions reasonably well at this point.
I hope so. But I just to protect myself, sometimes I'll say I'm an enthusiast more than an expert. but I get credit for being an expert on occasion.
Is there danger in what you do?
Yes. I have two presentations that I have that I offer to members of the American Chemical Society. One is a general survey subject where we talk about the history and chemistry of it. The second one is a safety presentation where I talk about the extreme precautions we take in order to do those types of tests safely. We've never had an incident in our lab that was an accident. Sometimes detonations, we call them, you know, decompositions or reactions. That just sounds better than explosions sometimes. But yes, there's always that potential, static discharge, arc discharge, and so we have contingencies in place, what ifs. So the building I work in has a large earthen barricade that is probably 18 or 20 feet tall to protect everyone else in this industrial area from my building should something bad happen. And the buildings are built so that if there is a major detonation, the force of the blast will be directed in a way where there's no the least amount of structural or personnel potential. So maybe the roof will blow off, the back wall will blow out, and the rest of the walls are reinforced and will withhold the blast. That is not something I've seen, not something I anticipate seeing, but we do a lot of things to stay
better
safe.
To be prepared. Do you have to wear special clothing when you...
We have, of course, non-flammable lab coats, and these are also static dispersive lab coats. They have conductive fibers in them. We wear safety shoes, like most industries do, that are steel-toed, but these are also conductive. So if a static potential builds up on me that's different than my environment, it'll drain through my shoes. But that's no good unless I have a floor that's conductive. Mm-hmm. So the floor is also grounded to earth. Some of the precautions we have to take, though, is if you have on synthetic socks, then that's plastic. That's an insulator. You may not drain, so we're not allowed to wear those kind of things. Insoles are made out of neoprene. That's rubber. Not allowed. Foot powders, these shoes are heavy. They're thick. Sometimes your feet sweat. But salt solutions, which is sweat, is an excellent conductor of electricity. So that's encouraged to maintain that. Sometimes we put wrist straps on. Some of the precautions we take are very similar to what...
To ground you.
To ground me. Very similar to what the electronics industry would use.
Mm-hmm.
But if the electronics industry has a static discharge or arc, they've lost a processor or a circuit.
You've lost a building. Yeah.
Or a person.
Or a person, yeah.
Okay. And all of our equipment is grounded and shielded and built to contain explosives if an explosion occurred inside the device.
Fascinating undertaking with some danger involved and like that. And tonight at 7 o'clock in the Anderson Building off of the Glacier Highway next to near the NOAA Lab. The old NOAA Lab. You'll be talking about this. It's Keith Butler, chief chemist at the Milan Army Ammunition Plant in Milan, Tennessee. And we've also had with us Lisa Hoferkamp. Are you a professor of chemistry?
I'm an associate.
An associate professor of chemistry. Fine.
Yes.
And you teach chemistry classes at the University of Alaska Southeast. Thank you so much for alerting us to this opportunity. I hope people come out and see it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, October the 20th, 2011. It's the birthday of Monica Ali, born in Dhaka, Bangladesh, 1967, English mother, Bangladeshi father. Family moved to England when she was a small child. She liked to write, but finally found the push that she needed when her grandfather died. She said, "There's something galvanizing about a funeral. I felt the need to not put things off any longer." That book that she wrote, her first novel, Brick Lane, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, later made into a film. She was named one of Granta Magazine's Best of Young British Novelists. Latest novel is Untold Story. It's the birthday of the poet Arthur Rimbaud, born in Charleville, France, 1854, wrote all of his poetry in the space of less than 5 years, from the age of 15 to the age of 20. Rimbaud, who experienced a form of synesthesia, a neurological condition in which sensory wires are crossed in the brain, stimuli like sounds or smells provoke an experience of color. Rimbaud seems to have experienced the most common form, grapheme color synesthesia, in which letters or numbers are perceived as having color. It's the birthday of Robert Pinsky, born Long Branch, New Jersey, 1940. Author of 19 books, poetry collections, and a collection of essays entitled Thousands of Broadways, Dreams and Nightmares of the American Small Town. Once asked how he got started as a poet, Robert Pinsky said, "Whatever makes a child want to glue macaroni on a paper plate and paint the assemblage and see it on the refrigerator, that has always been strong in me." It was on this date in 1967, two men, Roger Patterson and Robert Gimlin, living near Yakima, Washington, claimed to have captured Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the abominable snowman, on film. Most scientists who've seen it say that it's real footage of a human in a Bigfoot suit. Patterson died of lymphoma in 1972, maintained until the end that the film was no hoax. But years later, a costume maker named Philip Morris came forward and said that Patterson had ordered a large ape suit from him, and a man named Bob Hieronymus said that Patterson offered him $1,000 to wear the suit to make the movie. Here's a poem for today by George Bilgear, Busboy. Oh, teenage busboy of the summer dusk, lugging your gray tub of swill, bathed in slop and ooze and bits of spaghetti in the alley behind the Applebee's. Hate me, if you will, as I pass by in my tennis shorts and Obama t-shirt with a vibrant, dark-haired woman on my way to watch Game 3 of the NBA Finals at our local microbrewery. Hate me, but you cannot know that I once labored, as you do now, at a big boy in Riverside, California, elbow deep in the very same lumpish goop and ooze. Like you, I was of the slime of alleys, of the same immemorial cigarette butts and rotting cottage cheese. And like you, I dreamed of a certain waitress and of driving a fork into the forehead of the night manager and of spitting in the soup of plump, complacent, well-dressed diners who snapped their fingers at me. But most of all, I dreamed of being clean and cool and never, ever again slogging through the world's filth and stink, which is something I have achieved, as must be perfectly obvious to you. A poem by George Bilgear, Busboy, used by permission of the poet here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine. You can read the current issue of Poetry or listen to the monthly Editor's Podcast at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Fresh start, and we play the game. Arts Up on K2 is supported in part by the Juno Artist Gallery, a cooperative featuring the work of over 25 local artists and artisans. The Juno Artist Gallery is open year-round, located downtown in the Senate Building.
Reporting from the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Jacqueline Estes. The 2.5-day Elders and Youth Conference, which is hosted by the First Alaskans Institute, ended Wednesday. The Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention gets underway today. AFN Board Co-Chairman Albert Kukesh Klinkit says the theme, Strength in Unity, harkens to last year's race for a U.S. Senate seat for Alaska.
We want to get people to start thinking like we did when last year we got together to help Lisa Murkowski get elected. For the first time in the history of the Native people, we voted as a block all throughout Alaska, and that made a huge difference in her re-election. So we want people to start thinking about being united in that block, not just in voting. Let's see if the tribes and the corporations can start working together, maybe do something.
Mike Williams, Yupik, is chief of the Yupiat Nation, a consortium of several Western Alaska tribes. He says corporations created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, have a vital role as owners of the ancestral lands of tribal members. However, people born after 1971, when ANCSA was enacted, can become shareholders in the corporations, for the most part, only through inheritance. William says tribes represent all Alaska Natives and act as governments by enacting ordinances, enforcing the law, and in many other ways.
We provide essential services to the contract from Bureau of Indian Affairs to run our programs, Indian Child Welfare Act, tribal courts, housing, health care, etc., roads, and provide governmental services to our tribal members in our community. Whereas our Native corporation runs a business and tries to make money as much as possible, and that's what they do.
Kukesh says the corporations have tried to cooperate with tribes.
I'm part of the corporation world, but we've never fought the tribes. The tribes have always seemed to want to fight us, and that doesn't work very well. We think that we should have a relationship, that we have a good relationship with each other. For example, the other day they had objected to us applying for membership in the National Congress of American Indians. Well, because we knew that was contentious, the AFN board pulled that request for membership off the table. So that's the kind of things that we have to do to force some kind of unity among the people. That's fine.
Williams says ANCSA corporations are already represented at NCAI through their tribal delegates. He says NCAI is made up of more than 500 federally recognized tribes, and to allow businesses to become voting members would be inappropriate.
I have trouble with that because in government, if we allow Burger King or ConocoPhillips to start have the votes in government, then it would create problems.
The convention is holding a panel discussion on the subject of unity Thursday afternoon. Other presenters include U.S. Representative for Alaska Don Young, the 2011 Iditarod champion John Quiak Baker, NCAI President Jackie Johnson Pata, Inuit Circumpolar Conference Greenland President Aquila Linga, and Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley. Other events this week include an arts and crafts fair, dance performances, a traditional Athabascan fiddle dance, and many other activities. The AFN convention continues into Saturday. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
AFN news broadcasts produced by Kuwanis Broadcast Corporation in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding provided by Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, the Siri Foundation, Cook Inlet Tribal Council, ConocoPhillips, Donlund Gold, the Pebble Partnership, and South Central Foundation. You can help Native Broadcast Productions by taking the AFN Listener Survey found online at knba.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Tonight at 7 o'clock on KTOO, you can tune into the Alaska Identity Project. Tonight, host Adrian Lopez will interview Dave Gaudette, Marine Debris Program Coordinator for the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation. And then Chris Krentz, the Arctic Project Manager for Oceana, will be on from 7:30 to 8 p.m. So that's on the Alaska Identity Project, Thursday night, tonight, October 20th, here on KTOO. minutes to 4, and this is Pat Moore. I'm sitting in as guest host today while Jeff is up in Anchorage receiving a Lifetime Achievement in the Arts Award. And my guest, as always on Thursday afternoons, is the delightful, the wonderful, the incredible Nancy DeTerney.
Don't waste time with that. We're out.
Who is here to tell us about Arts?
Okay, and because we're not going to get all the way through it, you can get the complete calendar by going to either KTOO.org or JAHC.org. So, here we go. Music and theater. This is your last weekend to see 39 Steps. I'm out of breath because I'm late and I ran. 39 Steps is fabulous. It's Perseverance Theater, 364-2421. Get your tickets now. And then there's Midsummer's Night Dream. Theater in the Rough is doing that at McPheeters Hall. And we have out at the UAS Rec Center, Harrison B. Unplugged. He's doing a songwriting workshop, I think. And that's, I think, free to students and $3 or something for the rest of us. On Friday, there's the concert. There's an Alaska Day Ball. Have you talked with them?
Oh, yes. They were here earlier. Kit and the Caboodles were in our very studio.
All right.
Yes. Some of the Caboodles.
Some of the Caboodles. All right. So, and then on Saturday, there's a barn dance. The music is by Rumblefish. That's up at St. Anne's Parish Hall. And then Harris B. will be live at the Island Pub on Saturday. Holiday Pops rehearsals. It's already, can you believe it?
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Holiday
Pops. Time flies when you're in Juneau.
I guess so. Don't miss a beat here. Anyway, the Holiday Pop stuff is starting up the rehearsals. They're rehearsing 3 o'clock to, I think, 5 on Sundays and 6:45 on Tuesdays at Thunder Mountain. The Sunday one is at Northern Light Church. They will be rehearsing all the way through till December 11th when they'll perform. And you don't have to have any background in singing. You just have to like to sing. So
do you call somebody or do you just show up?
I think you can just show up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where do you show again?
Northern Light Church at 3 o'clock on Sunday.
Okay.
Thunder Mountain High School, 6:45 on Tuesday. And the Bee Eaters, this is an acoustic sort of guitar group, I guess. Really nice music. I was listening to it on CD Baby. They are out at the Rec Center, UAS Rec Center. This is free for students and $3 to the public. That's at 7:30 on Monday. And the Fraternal Order of the Alaska State Troopers brings Lori Morgan in concert to the Centennial Hall on Wednesday at 7:30. If they haven't called you at home to sell you a ticket, you can get one at Hearthside Books or Roswick Giles. Now, Woosh Canadier is having their Grand Slam, Parallel Trails, big deal. It's a whole year of poetry. It's been great.
They told us a little bit about that yesterday.
So we don't have to talk about that anymore, unless the people didn't
tune
in yesterday.
It is nice, because it's the winners of all of the slams, each presenting a poem. So it's a little different setup, but should be very good.
This is at the Canvas, if you have never been there. Also, the evening at Egan on Friday is Trickster Reads Scripture, Story and Truth in a Post-Secular Age. This is at the Egan Lecture Hall. It sounds very interesting.
We'll be talking with Saul tomorrow.
Okay, we won't bring that up anymore. David Van is at the Downtown Library. He's an author. I can't remember the name of the book right at the moment, but he'll be there on Wednesday at 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
We've got really interesting films at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. They're doing Tabloid, which is it's a documentary, quite interesting. Also, the Alaska Native Cultures film series is this Thursday. I think it's tonight. The Drums of Winter, that's out at the UAS Lecture Hall. It's Rocky Horror Picture Show time. I mean, you know. That's on Friday at 9:30 at night. That's too early.
That's at Nickelodeon?
No, that's at the Goldtown Nickelodeon.
Yeah. Do you come in costume and get in free, do you know, or
I don't
not?
Know. Bring your toast.
Okay,
I don't know.
Right.
And they're also showing the 2011 Real Rock Tour film series thing, and I saw the previews for this, and I'm still, scary.
These are climbing films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or coming down films.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Also, they're doing their kids' matinees on Sunday again. They're showing Sleepy Hollow, and it's The Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown. That's at 2 p.m. on Sundays. There's Anna Brown Ellers is doing Chilkat Weaving Techniques workshops for kids in grades 3 through 5. This is on Saturday. There's a session at 10 in the morning and another set at 1 o'clock. And they still have some room in those. They do ask that you pre-register.
That's at the State Museum,
mm-hmm,
right? Yeah.
465-2901. So if you're interested in having your child learn about Chilkat weaving, this is a really great opportunity. Lecture on the Norwegian polar explorer Roald Amundsen. The Sons of Norway are presenting this at the Juno Yacht Club on Saturday at 7 p.m. You can go to the Marie Drake Planetarium and hear about Kronos and Saturn. That's at 6:30 on Tuesday. And that's always an interesting, a lot of people don't realize or maybe have never been to the planetarium. We have the largest one in the state, I believe. Hmm. So it's been there for a long time. Also, if you want to learn how to sew pajama pants, you can go out to the Rain Tree Quilting Store on Monday at 6 o'clock. They're having that. There's a Halloween carnival and haunted house out at the Nugget Mall, 5:30 on Friday and Saturday. The alumni beer and wine tasting at the Prospector Hotel on Friday at 6 o'clock. They still have some tickets available. So, also the Breast Fest, the Rotaract people are doing that at 8 o'clock on Saturday. Like I said, if you need the whole thing, you know where to go.
You bet. Thank you, Nancy.
All right, we'll see you.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow afternoon on Juno Afternoon, I'll be talking with Jonas Lamb from the Juno Public Library about a new language program and some other features that the library has added recently. And Saul Neely, of course, will be here to tell us about the Evening at Egan presentation that he's going to be giving tomorrow night. We'll hear from the new coordinator of Canvas, and Russell Strantman will be here to tell us about the lecture he'll be delivering tomorrow night about Roald Amundsen's trip to the South Pole. All of that will be on Juno Afternoon, tomorrow afternoon. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, you can tune to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269AO. You'll hear us at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM. They tune their radios to 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah. It's tuned there at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you set your dial to 89.9 and listen to KTOO News on K210AS. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable, Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. Our sister station KRNN is on 872, and KXLL is on 873. We're also online at k2oo.org.